And Dr. John McDougall here with information for your good health. Second hour, it's going to be open lines. We're going to talk about all kinds of things, including the seminar that will be coming up in San Diego next Saturday. And that'll be the 17th of June. Talk about all kinds of things. And Dr. John McDougall here with information for your good health. Second hour, it's going to be open lines. We're going to talk about all kinds of things, including the seminar that will be coming up in San Diego next.
Here now is Dr. John McDougall.
And Dr. John McDougall here with information for your good health. Second hour, it's going to be open lines. We're going to talk about all kinds of things, including the seminar that will be coming up in San Diego next Saturday. And that'll be the 17th of June. It's going to be some half-day life-changing experience. We'll tell you more about that. We'll also tell you about an event coming up this Friday and Saturday that's free, open to the public. Well, not really. In other words, I can get you free tickets for that event. It's going to be the health show, which includes all kinds of interesting folks, including Dr. Dean Ornish, Bernie Siegel, John Robbins, Art Ulane, Robert Pritikin, Dr. John McDougall, and so on. I'm going to tell you how to get free tickets for that, and we'll tell you, that'll all come the second hour. But this first hour, I have the privilege of bringing to you one of the people who's made a great impression on me, and I think will make a great difference when it comes to the treatment of breast cancer in the near future. This is a man who's kind of stepped out of line. Even though he's one of the established doctors, he's professor of medicine, UCLA School of Medicine. I met him about 8 years ago when I was browsing through the scientific literature, and I saw an article about breast cancer treatment. And what that article addressed was whether or not women who have breast cancer would be foolish enough, bold enough, strong enough, interested enough to change their diet after they got breast cancer. And Dr. Rowan Chabowski wrote an article stating that he found clearly women faced with this deadly disease would make a sensible change to a good diet. Welcome to the show, Dr. Chabowski.
Yes, pleasure to be here. Thank you for the kind introduction.
The newspapers today carried an article entitled Prostate Cancer Stalks Bay Area Black Men, and I have also several other articles that tell us that breast cancer is much more aggressive in black women, particularly black women under the age of 45. Prostate cancer is much more aggressive in and much more common in black men. Is this a genetic issue that we're talking about here?
Oh, we're talking about the racial differences between African-American and other, say, United States populations with respect to, say, breast cancer and prostate cancer. We're certainly, as you stated, it's clear that there's a excess burden of cancers and bad outcome in that population. It's been gotten quite a bit of attention recently, and it looks like when you try to take into account all known prognostic factors, genetic factors, you can account for maybe about only about half the excess, kind of bad outcome or bad instance and outcome. And so there's a big X factor in that equation as well. Certainly, diet could be a part of that X factor, but there's a big part of the racial differences that we don't understand, but it's clearly there.
Well, why would anybody think diet had anything to do with breast or prostate cancer?
Well, I mean, that's a kind of a big question, but it goes back maybe about 15 or 20 years when, for the first time, country-to-country differences in outcome start in terms of cancer registries from different countries were able to be compared, where reliable information was put together, and it became clear there was tremendous difference between major cancers from different countries. For colon and breast cancers, to 8 to 10-fold different incidence. So in the United States, which we have about 185,000 breast cancers a year, other countries which have different diets, so there's a lot of other things that are different as well. If they had the same incidence, our incidence of breast cancer would be a rare disease, maybe 18,000 cases a year. So that got people's attention, and then basically a lot of animal experimentation, a lot of theoretical considerations make it a reasonable, plausible hypothesis that dietary fat has a lot to do with several of these cancers, including prominently breast and prostate and probably colon cancer as well.
Well, taking it back to black American women and men and prostate cancer and breast cancer, how is it with the African blacks?
In terms of
breast and prostate cancer, is it a common disease in Africa among black women and black men?
No, so those are kind of rare diseases there. And
what could account, since it's the same genetic material? I mean, can you come right out and say it? What is the thing that could account for the difference?
The big difference of that comparison, of course, is going to be diet. And in those kind of countries, dietary fat intakes would be clearly less than half, maybe one-third of, maybe even less than that, of what our usual daily saturated fat, unsaturated fat, total fat intakes are. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a kind of a major, major factor.
Well, my accounts, the things that I've read about the early studies of the black Africans was that breast and prostate cancer were essentially non-existent.
That's right. So pretty much kind of a reportable incident diseases there. And then yet, with the same genetic background, essentially here in different countries, not only the United States, but other countries as well, end up having a devastating kind of condition that... That isn't seen in countries of origin for these populations.
Due to change in diet.
Sure.
And enthusiastic adoption of the rich American diet. With great enthusiasm, some of the people who become Americanized eat the Western diet. And the results are devastating and obvious.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I think that that basically that was one, and it has been historically, certainly, maybe it's just beginning to change, but only just beginning, where one measure of one's status was not only what kind of house you live in, what kind of car you drive, but what kind of food you ate. And it's an unfortunate carryover, but I think maybe it's difficult to get an expensive $40,000 or $50,000 car, but you can eat high-fat foods, and so we've really kind of... kind of put an extra burden on our probably lower socioeconomic populations, where that's the one way in which they can most readily assume a higher lifestyle.
In this article, as well as the other scientific articles that have been published lately about breast cancer in black women and prostate cancer in black men, it also talks about the aggressiveness of the disease. It's a much more aggressive disease in these people. Again, is that genetic, or is that because of the enthusiastic consumption of the rich Western high-fat diet?
Yeah, you know, it seems to be very likely to be related to the Western high-fat diet. I mean, we've been working, you know, as you mentioned, we're in the process of doing a large-scale 2,000-woman, 32-institution randomized trial for looking at dietary fat reduction as a potential additional therapy for patients with resected breast cancer. And some of the basic information is that in taking human breast tumors, growing them in vitro, just by changing the fat concentration, one can stimulate greatly the breast cancer growth. So these are human breast cancers grown in vitro situations, or put in experimental animal models. The same tumors taken from women will metastasize more likely and grow more rapidly just based on the diet that is being taken in.
Well, Dr. Chbosky, yep. We're going to tell women about your study and mm-hmm. tell them how to get in touch with the study group. And most exciting, we're going to tell them about how changing diet can make a huge difference in a woman who already has breast cancer, to say nothing of those women who want to prevent breast cancer. My guest, Dr. Rowan Chbosky, he's an oncologist, professor of medicine, University UCLA School of Medicine, Division of Medical Oncology, Harbor UCLA Medical Center. The lines are open for you at 707-270-1350. That's 707-270-1350. And I'm Dr. John McDougall, and we'll have more information for your good health.
Phenylpropanolamine hydrochloride.
If you'd like to ask Dr. John McDougall's guest a question, call now, 707-270-1350, 707-270-1350.
And with me is the co-director, co-principal investigator of the Women's Intervention Nutrition Study, Dr. Rowan Chbosky, a man who, I'd have to assume, through our conversation so far, believes the diet has something to do with the cause, and wishes to find out whether or not diet would have something to do with the treatment of breast cancer. And if you want to be involved in the study that may eventually show whether or not diet will make a big difference in the outcome of a woman who already has breast cancer. I mean, you know, this almost sounds like quackery. When I went to medical school, if anybody even suggested that diet had anything to do with cancer, you were labeled unorthodox if they were kind that day, and a quack if they're in their usual mood. The number to get involved in this study is 310-222-217. And I'll give you that number again, so get your pencils and paper ready. Isn't that true, Dr. Chbosky? I mean, when you and I went through our initial training, diet and cancer mixed up in the same sentence would immediately revoke a very negative response from our colleagues.
I think that's certainly correct. I mean, it may be true even now that dietary interventions commonly viewed as being potentially weak as compared to giving chemotherapy or surgery or radiation therapy treatments. But I think the prospects are that the magnitude of benefit associated with achieving significant dietary change might be just as great as could be achieved by any of those other modalities, and it certainly can be taken in addition to them. It's not, I think we're not saying just do a diet and don't do all the other things. This is something that can be done in addition to what this kind of standard therapy or best available therapy at the present time.
All right, well, let me just stop you there. You're a board-certified oncologist. You know all about the therapies out there for women with breast cancer. Let me just ask you about a few. Does surgery save lives?
Well, it's an interesting question. Certainly, you want to take the tumor out, but I think as you kind of, and you want to find the tumors early, it appears that at some point it must save lives, otherwise the screening mammography wouldn't be effective. But as you know, with the breast-sparing procedures, it becomes a little harder to tell. If you can just take a little bit of the breast out and get the same result as taking the whole breast out, that raises some questions about surgery. But certainly, surgery has to be effective at some stage to cause screen versus not screen populations with mammography to benefit.
But it doesn't help women under 50 or over 69?
Yeah, it may not. That's right.
In other words, it's questionable.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And if you understand the natural history of breast cancer, it being a 10 to 15-year-old disease by the time it's diagnosed, it's easy to understand why operating on the local tumor in the breast doesn't cure.
Yeah, so it looks like other factors are determining outcome at that point.
How about radiotherapy? Radiation therapy, does that change the survival for women with breast cancer?
Well, I think it's back to the same question. Certainly will reduce the incidence of recurrences in the breast if you have a breast-sparing procedure, but that doesn't appear to improve overall survival for groups receiving that radiation therapy or not.
Okay, so I'm not speaking too much out of turn if I say that surgery and radiation do not affect survival positively to any great extent.
Well, I think they must at some point. I think I think it's probably true for a lot of women that it's difficult that can't be the answer.
Okay. In other words, it's not a great treatment.
Yeah,
let's put it that way. But what I'm trying to do is put it in perspective.
Sure.
Here, you're trying to suggest that we deal with the cause of a disease, and after women get breast cancer, we take the stance: let's stop throwing gasoline on a fire. In other words, let's change their diet after they even have the disease. And we're comparing that with other therapies that have been used for 100 years, radiation therapy since 1939, and it has been shown over and over again that these are of extremely limited effectiveness, and yet we have these therapies being held up as standard practice that's administered to every woman, and something like good diet, I bet, is never... Well, let me put it more accurately, is rarely, very rarely mentioned to a patient when she goes in to see her oncologist.
Yeah, I'd say it's almost never.
Almost never.
Almost never. When you look at what being viewed as a critical component of a recommended treatment regimen, treatment approach, it's almost never recommended now. And I think, the oncologist would say, in a certain sense, that it hasn't been proven in randomized trials. Of course, that's what we're trying to do now. But I think for many other things, where you have so many other benefits in terms of heart disease benefit, all these other parts that are proven, it just seems to be prudent to consider adapting this change rather than not recommending it to anyone.
Well, can you explain to me why we have enthusiastic support for radical surgery, mutilating surgery, and radiation, which has many, many side effects, enthusiastic support over the years when the studies show no survival benefit, and you have to adjust your thinking a little bit to give it the survival edge that you even gave it. Why do we have that enthusiastic support for those therapies, and yet something as simple, non-toxic, self-administered, cost-free as changing the cause of the disease, in other words, the diet, is not being given to women as advice?
Well, I think it goes back a little bit to the way we've been trained, and I think you alluded to that in medical school, and I think we're both the same kind of generational period, and it certainly maybe is changing slowly but not very rapidly. So basically you're taught, we're exposed to a number of disciplines, and I think you tend to adapt from the information that you get as a background and go from there, and the nutrition background, basic information has really just been not... viewed as being as important or not is so important to provide to people. I think that is changing now, not only certainly based on the fact that the federal government and leading investigators are getting involved in the kind of studies that we're doing, and also we're also participating. It was one of the 40 sites in the Women's Health Initiative, which is going to enter, you know, upwards of 160,000 women over a three-year period, following them for 10 years. And one of the components is a 48,000 women randomized trial to with a major dietary change to reduce fat, increase fruits and vegetables and grains. And so at least the background is changing now.
We'll find more about the study and how women can get involved in the study. My guest, Dr. Rowan Chabowski. I'm Dr. John McDougall. I'll be back with more information for your good health.
Avoid the knife. There's mounting
If you'd like to ask Dr. John McDougall's guest a question, call now, 707-270-1350, 707-270-1350.
Since before 1988, Dr. Rowan Chabowski has been working with the Women's Intervention Nutrition Study, where a simple concept has been employed in study design, and that is take women who have breast cancer, which is believed to be due to the rich Western diet, and change their diet after they get breast cancer to see if you can help them live longer. Certainly, they're going to live better. If you'd like to get involved in that study, the number to call is 310-52-17. That's 310-222-2217. Dr. Chabowski, can I suggest that things are going to change drastically in the near future, very near future, because the payment system is changing so that insurance companies are no longer paying for sickness instead. They're encouraging hospitals and doctors and research people to look at disease in terms of prevention and humane, effective treatment. And therefore, what you're doing right now, which seems radical, may actually be mainstream when the system of payment changes here in the next few months.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the arguments that I continually make is looking at the potential cost effectiveness is that these kinds of approaches, which people actually can do with a kind of a minimum of health professional assistance. I mean, there's directed programs, but basically people can don't need many visits with some kind of specialist or anything, and the cost of that is so low that even a small benefit would be so much more effective than doing very expensive things. And so it's the kind of thing that's going to be tested in more and more different settings, I believe.
For economic reasons.
Sure.
And that's the truth. It should have been done for humane reasons, but it hasn't been. And let's go to your phone calls. Kathleen, welcome to Your Good Health. You're on with Dr. Chabowski.
Hi. I was wondering if I was looking for an opinion on, I was diagnosed with a pituitary adenoma about 10 years ago, and I had always been followed by an endocrinologist, and that endocrinologist had always told me never take synthetic estrogens. And recently I saw a gynecologist who told me that was not true and that I could take synthetic estrogens, like, you know, the pill. And I was wondering if you could give me any information about that or if you knew anything about that.
Dr. Chabowski, do you know anything about the association between taking estrogens and pituitary adenomas?
No, not too much. I think the kind of the issue, I guess, is, you know, as you know, the kind of the estrogens are interesting because, of course, they have a potential major role in reducing incidence of coronary heart disease in terms of through changes in lipid profiles, but they seem to, one of the downsides that's being trying to get into balance is whether increased incidence of breast cancer, which can potentially occur with that, plus other cancers, might be the reason why the recommendation was made. Pituitary adenoma is a kind of a rare condition, so I doubt that there would be big
Have you ever heard that pituitary adenomas are caused by a high-fat diet?
No, I haven't.
What do you think about doctors who treat women with breast cancer with hormone replacement therapy to prevent osteoporosis?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those questions. We certainly have been, we've been told, and because estrogen does in lower doses can stimulate appears to be associated with some increased incidence of breast cancer, not to use it. But the question is whether there is good data to support that recommendation. No, and now that issue is being revisited, and it's becoming a little bit more of an open question than it was a few years ago.
Well, how do you feel about it, though? I mean, would you take a woman who has breast cancer and put her on hormone replacement therapy to save her bones?
Well, currently, I wouldn't make that recommendation with existing information that's out there, but I recognize it's becoming an open issue now as to whether what the balance is going to be. Certainly, as we get better numbers about what the relative risk will be, we'll be able to make a better assessment in a few years. But for right now, I think you really have to take an individual woman's risk of, you know, kind of bone disease, risk of heart disease into account before making that recommendation. I think what's going to happen for a lot of these things, like hormone replacement therapy, in specific instances, are going to be an individual risk profile be able to be generated for that woman for the three or four diseases that may be impacted either positively or negatively in coming up with a decision. I think before we were trying to do one size fits all, and it probably would miss the mark a little bit.
Dr. Chbosky, you know, the people who are listening to us must think that you and I are very confused on how to treat breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine how bad they feel when they go to see a doctor and they're offered various treatments when they see us as not knowing how to deal with this disease?
No, I think I see that every day. It's a tremendous problem for women with this disease because there's a number of different ways, approaches to therapy and some of the things that we've already mentioned. And for some of the individual decisions, there isn't a clear-cut answer.
And because there are so many different opinions, there seems to be no ideal way, and the patient isn't getting the miracle of modern medicine, at least as far as I can see. My guest, Dr. Rowan Chbosky, lines are open for you at 707-270-1350. And I'm Dr. John McDougall, and I'll be back with more information for your good health.
Here's to your good health. Bye.
If you'd like to ask Dr. John McDougall's guest a question, call now, 707-270-1350, 707-270-1350.
And Dr. John McDougall, there's lines open for you at 707-270-1350. Let me give you that again. Let's do it real slow now. If I can't say it, how in the world can you write it down? 707-270-1350. A chance to talk to one of the world-renowned oncologists and also a real pioneer in terms of breast cancer treatment, especially when it comes to diet, which is really a bold move. Dr. Rowan Chbosky. Dr. Chbosky is a professor of medicine, UCLA School of Medicine, Division of Medical Oncology, Harbor UCLA Medical Center. Couldn't get much more established than that. And we have Mildred on the line. Mildred, welcome to Your Good Health. You're on with Dr. Chbosky.
Yes, I received the American Institute for Cancer Research letter, which I get because I had the mastectomy 3 years ago. And there's a Dr. Milner in there, and they say that he was one of the first to investigate garlic cancer preventive potential.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're offering him a grant to help him find out how garlic may inhibit the development of breast cancer as well as the other lung, colon, and liver. And, of course, so I wanted his opinion on that.
Yeah, no, I think there, in addition to dietary fat, certainly there's been information implicating fruits and vegetables in terms of being potentially associated with changes in breast cancer and increased fiber as well. Now, things like garlic would be another component that has the same kind of kind of background supportive data, maybe not quite as much experimental, in the laboratory or animal data to support it, but becoming, again, a clinical focus. I think a lot of these things are evolving now as looking at kind of whole foods and as opposed to individual nutrients. And I think now we're getting into the realm of trying to dissect out whether we know enough to be able to say you don't have to take the whole food, but you just have to take this one nutrient. So it's something that's under investigation, probably a little less data than, say, dietary fat at the present time in breast cancer, but it's something that's under active investigation, as you point out. It's worthwhile to consider.
It'll do you no harm, Mildred.
Yes, thank you.
So thank you very much for calling.
Okay.
Dr. Chbosky, if you were going to give the best advice possible, I don't want to hear about what you think people are capable of doing in terms of dietary change. I don't want to hear about a moderate diet or a prudent diet. I want the best medicine. I don't care how big the pill is to swallow. What would be the best way if I had breast or prostate cancer or even colon cancer? What would be the best way for me to change my diet?
Well, I think the easiest place to start is to try to get out as much of all types of fat in the diet as you can. And as you know, and I'm sure maybe some of your audience knows, that that's going to mean, at least for many people, about a 50 or 60% reduction in their fat in the diet. In our study, we're targeting 15% of calories from fat. You can go a little lower than that. That probably would be ideal, where you're just getting the minimal requirements for certain fats. That's a tougher dietary change. It probably would be the one that might be most associated with the most benefit. I think that would be the key component of any dietary change. Certainly, increasing the fiber may be important as well in fruits and vegetables, but all those things would come along with making that type of major reduction in dietary fat intake to about 15% or less from a percent of calories from fat.
Whew, I thought you were going to say the V word, vegetarian.
No.
Good. I was a little worried there. You were getting close.
No,
every time we talk, you get a little closer, you know.
Well, I know. I think of course, if going to 15% calories from fat, between 15 or 20, I mean, that's the kind of thing where most of the participants, none of the participants are really would have to be vegetarians, and almost all of them are having a increase. Intake of a variety of meats and fish products, things like that. So one can do it by just changing, kind of tweaking aspects of what you eat, but the other way to get the most extreme change would be actually totally changing the whole component of your dietary outlook.
And Nancy, welcome to Your Good Health. You're on with Dr. Rowan Chabowski.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm a 55-year-old woman, and I weigh 125 pounds. I've been doing low-fat for 20 years. I've taken no hormone replacement therapy because I haven't had any symptoms. But my question is, they're always telling me I have many calcifications, and I have to go in every 6 months for a mammogram.
Mm-hmm.
What is the significance of this? This has been going on for 6 years. And I was sent to a surgeon one time, but he decided not to do a biopsy. He did a follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never had a biopsy, but every 6 months they want me in.
Yeah, that's one of the issues in terms of mammographic early detection, which is certainly has been demonstrated in the over 50 populations to result in a reduction in mortality from breast cancer. But one of the problems is that it sounds like in women like yourselves, there's a group of women who have breasts that create problems in diagnosis with mammography. Basically, some of these calcifications, which can be associated with benign conditions, also may be harbingers or the first indications of very small kind of malignant growths in the breast. And so there is a tremendous amount of judgment involved in terms of determining whether these are suspicious enough to biopsy, and I could see, like in your case, it makes for a very potentially anxiety-providing situation to have
right.
to go from kind of checkup to wonder what the answer will be.
So is this the kind of woman that you'd suggest changes her diet?
I mean that. Actually, it's interesting that the investigators in Toronto, Dr. Boyd, actually had patients with a different condition. They ended up having symptoms associated with abnormal mammographic findings, and showed that their symptoms improved, and they had some improvement in their mammographic readings by adopting a low-fat diet. This is from Dr. Boyd from the University of Toronto did this study. And so somebody like yourself actually, you're already there. So maybe there's nothing else that you can do. It might be worthwhile to see exactly how much fat you are intaking, really have it checked out, because I think many women we talk to in all these kinds of studies will say that they're on a low-fat diet. And, of course, your weight indicates that you may well be. But oftentimes people kind of underestimate a little bit exactly how low their dietary fat intake is.
Well, if it says no fat, I automatically count a half a gram of fat,
mm-hmm.
since that doesn't have to be put on the nutritional labels if it's under a half. So I figure even the half gram.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so how low do you think you have your fat intake, Nancy?
I try to keep it to 10 grams a day. That's why I have to count every half gram.
I see. Okay.
My father had very genetically high cholesterol, and I did too, but I have it down to 209 with my diet and no drugs.
That sounds like you've made some great progress. Where did it start at?
Pardon?
Where did your cholesterol start at?
When I was very, I had a bypass when I was 33 years old.
Oh,
but that
my goodness.
Was because I was born, it was a, what do you call it? I was born with a defective artery. But it used to be way over 300.
So you've made great progress.
Yes, I have. I've made a lot of progress.
And Dr. Chabowski believes that progress you've made will be an advantage to you in terms of breast cancer in the future. Thank you very much for calling. My guest, Dr. Rowan Chabowski. He is with the UCLA Department of Medicine. And also, we'll tell you about the study that involves treating women with breast cancer with a healthy diet. I'm Dr. John McDougall, and I'll be back with more information for your good health. And Dr. John McDougall here with information for your good health from UCLA School of Medicine, Division of Medical Oncology. Also, the co-principal investigator and clinical director of the Women's Intervention Nutrition Study, Dr. Rowan Chabowski. And his phone number, if you'd like to get involved in that study, is 310-222-2217. That's 5 2s and a 1 7. And let's go right back to our phone lines. Annan, welcome to Your Good Health. You're on with Dr. Chabowski.
Hi. I have a question about being black and having cancer, because I do have it, and I found out that you get discriminated in the system, and I've been butchered through my surgeries and left emotionally and psychologically unable to handle all of this. And then where do you go from here?
Well, what kind of cancer did you have, Anna?
Oh, breast cancer.
Breast cancer, and you felt that you were treated poorly?
Yeah, I know.
And you thought it was because you were black?
Yes. Some, as you go to the hospitals and as you deal with the doctors, that becomes a factor, because after they finish their major surgeries and get their monies involved in the...
Well, Dr. Chabowski, this certainly has been brought up in terms of bypass surgery. Blacks have been discriminated against in terms of bypass surgery, and women have been discriminated against in terms of heart disease. This is a common topic in the scientific literature. Do you think this type of discrimination exists in terms of cancer treatment?
I mean, the possibility is there. Certainly people have begun to explore who gets offered certain types of therapies, and basically it gets down to sometimes and the way things are offered, and unfortunately sometimes it does get down to this kind of racial stereotyping in terms of what kind of explanation. For instance, I can imagine one situation where at least the literature supports that the people may not give much of an explanation, because they think the woman won't be able to understand it because she's of a certain ethnic background, and then basically it creates a not very favorable situation. So I think that certainly can occur. I mean, you would hope that one would have the wherewithal or be able to switch and find a care provider that would be more sympathetic, certainly.
Well, Dr. Chabowski, that's kind of how you and I met, when I read your article that addressed a common attitude in the medical business, which was women are too stupid and too disinterested to change their diet after they get breast cancer, and you decided to prove that was nonsense.
That's right.
So this kind of attitude does exist in the medical business, and it's one that patients have to deal with.
Yeah, I think basically for the caller's answer, I think unfortunately that means you have to take charge. You end up having to be more aggressive, more assertive in terms of getting the information that you think you need.
Annan, thank you very much for calling. If you'd like to talk to my guest, the number is 707-270-1350. Now, you mentioned, Dr. Chabowski, that you had to cut back all fat, and I have to guess you were probably saying we have to cut back on the good fats too, like olive oil and corn oil and safflower oil?
Well, you know, I think at least from looking at the literature and looking at the kinds of situations trying to make a guess is what are the good fats. In breast cancer, it's a little harder. And certainly in the animal system, let's go from the top. The animal systems, it looks like the polyunsaturated fats are really bad for you.
Like corn oil and safflower.
Like corn oil, that's right. And so that would be the switch that many people would feel would be a helpful switch for cardiovascular disease. But the human studies suggest that saturated fats aren't good for you, right? And so we don't know about the unsaturated fats, but the suggestion is very powerful that they may not be very good for you. That leaves, of course, the ones in the middle, the ones that you're beginning to mention, that might be okay, but that may be only because we don't have enough information. So one could make a guess as to what the good fats would be for breast cancer, but it might be a little bit premature. So when I say all fats, I'm really focusing on at least the information on saturated fats and polyunsaturated. The monos, unsaturated fats, maybe you were alluding to, leave you some room in the middle. Maybe you want to expand on that a little bit.
So to be prudent, the best thing to do is to get the fat as low in the diet as possible and increase the vegetable intake. And Gene, welcome to Your Good Health. You're on with Dr. Chabowski. Hello, Gene.
It's called mycosis fungoides, and it started when I was 11 with the precursor. It's called parapsoriasis. I wondered if you knew anything about that and if you could talk about it. I'm 54.
Oh, in terms of a little bit of a different category, kind of mycosis fungoides is kind of more of a...
I can hardly hear you. Could you speak a little louder?
It's a subcategory of lymphomas, and I'm not aware of a dietary relationship for that disease, so I don't know if I could say much about that with respect to diet.
Well, would it be fair to say, regardless of what's wrong with her, she ought to eat a good diet?
Yeah, I think there doesn't seem to be any downside to adapting these kind of dietary practices. For other conditions, it sounds like this has been going on for a while, and that may not be the health problem, your major health problem. We'll have to see.
Gene, you got nothing to lose, so give it a try. There are other cancers, like prostate cancer, that's, you know, just like breast cancer, isn't it?
Yeah, I think if we look at the cancers where there's really pretty good data, where you might anticipate major reductions or benefits from in terms of making this dietary fat reduction we're talking about, I think we're really talking about prostate, breast, and colon cancer. And I think the other ones would be a little bit more by inference than by as much direct information that supports prostate, breast, and colon cancer.
Well, the medical business may get so bold as to recommend dietary changes for people with these problems, but, you know, I haven't seen a patient in a long time that didn't need this kind of advice if it wasn't for obesity or constipation or heart disease or whatever.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I think certainly that when you look at the causes of death, take postmenopausal women, causes of death, postmenopausal women, probably a majority of two-thirds of them will be due to colon cancer, breast cancer, and heart disease.
My guest, Dr. Rowan Chabowski. I'm Dr. John McDougall, and I'll be back with more information for your good health.
Like to talk with Dr. John McDougall, call now, 707-270-1350. That's 707-270-1350.
My guest, Dr. Rowan Chabowski, with the Women's Intervention Nutrition Study. That's a study where if you have cancer of the breast and you'd like to change your diet and be a part of the study, then you give the following number a call. It's 310-222-2217. That's 5 2s and a 1 7. So what's the answer to the question, Dr. Chabowski? Do women follow the low-fat, high-fiber, healthy diet once they have breast cancer?
They appear to, and the adherence by the group seems to be very good. And, of course, one of the problems you have is, self-reported food records, because you have to ask people what they're eating, or they write down what they're eating, or you call them up and ask them what they're eating. And so it's possible to say, well, that's really just a self-report. What does that mean? But when we look at this group, their weight changes. They lose weight. So the weight is different. The estrogen profiles are more favorable. That is, the circulating estradiol levels are lower. And it looks like now that there's changes actually in free fatty acid profiles, so we may be able to get an individual signature of somebody's biochemical signature of what they're eating. So it looks like, by all parameters, women are able to do it. And quite frankly, some of these changes are pretty easy to do once you know what's at stake and once you try it.
Well, hopefully you can convince our colleagues to make this recommendation, because that would help a lot. Thank you very much for being with me, Dr. Chabowski.
Sure, you're welcome.
I'm Dr. John McDougall, and I'll be back with more information for your good health.